Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Numbers don't always tell the whole story, you know. Like this one, we learned today the economy has been growing for 15 straight months. So if that's not enough to really end a recession, what do you have to do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, everybody, the 29th of October. Good, as always, to have you here. The White House wasted no time in taking note of today's report on gross domestic product. Five straight quarters of positive economic growth. But the president's top economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, did offer a caveat. Faster growth, he said, is needed to bring down the unemployment rate more quickly. So if an annual growth rate of 2% isn't enough, what is? We asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to take a stab at finding out what the number might be and how we might get there.
It's simple mathematics, really. To come up with a growth rate that's high enough to start putting Americans back to work, we need to factor in how productive those who do have jobs have been. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial.
Productivity is essentially the rate of growth at which companies are evolving to get more product out of fewer people.
In other words, much of the demand for goods and services is being absorbed by those already employed. And until demand outpaces the number of workers that companies are getting by with, the rate of growth isn't fast enough.
Right now, productivity is running at a 4% rate. So we need GDP growth of 4 to 4.5 just to pull the unemployment rate down.
How we get there isn't such a simple equation. At Decision Economics, Managing Director Kerry Leahy says it would help to sell more goods and services overseas. Our manufacturing exports are on the rise. But the catch-22 is other countries, notably China and Germany, are counting on the same thing.
If everyone tries to run a trade surplus, you got to have somebody run trade deficits.
And at High Frequency Economics, Ian Shepherdson says even if we do sell more abroad, it won't be enough.
Bearing in mind that exports only comprise about 12% of GDP, it's pretty clear that that's not going to be the salvation. The U.S. really is a big domestic economy, and what we need is domestic spending, and what that needs is domestic credit.
Not only so consumers can spend more, he says, but also to prime the pump for small businesses that employ half of all American workers. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Somewhere out there today, some bank manager someplace is about to have his Friday afternoon completely wrecked. Fridays are when federal regulators come in and close down troubled banks. Miami-based Bank United went belly up after filling up on risky adjustable rate mortgages a couple of years ago. The FDIC took it over, sold it off to a group of private equity firms about a year and a half ago. Today, those investors said they are ready to take Bank United public again. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Usually, profitable banks absorb other banks, but the government sold Bank United to a group of private equity firms for about $900 million. In the first half of this year, the new owners made more than $100 million in net income. Not a bad return on investment in 18 months. Bank United's buyers included heavy hitters like Blackstone and the Carlyle Group.
The FDIC handed Carlyle a multi-million dollar gift.
That's Jack Oblin, chief investment officer of Harris Private Bank in Chicago. He says the government's Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was supposed to make sure the investors shored up the bank's value, but instead,
most of the heavy lifting was done by the FDIC. They handed off guarantee the first 80% of the downside and virtually hand the buyer a pretty much a clean slate.
It cost the government $5 billion to unload the bank, but it could have been worse, could have been stuck with billions more in losses. But the FDIC set up some limits. The private equity firm had to hold on to the bank and run it. Now that the bank's going public, the investors have a chance to recoup their money and then some.
That's exactly what you want.
Sharon O'Halloran is a political economist at Columbia University.
They held the bank for 18 months. They shored up its capital reserves. It wasn't a run on the bank. They did add value to it.
When the IPO goes forward, it'll be the first failed bank bought by private investors after the meltdown to go public. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The television networks, Fox and CBS and NBC and all the rest of them, have been watching younger viewers disappear for years now. If they want to know where they've gone, they may well try taking a look at Univision. The Spanish language network has been making big gains in 18 to 34-year-olds with that particular brand of steamy soap opera known as the telenovela. Univision has also attracted a growing share of advertisers, but as Jennifer Collins reports, a telenovela that debuts on Monday takes it to a whole new level.
A beautiful young woman inherits an ad agency, has a steamy romance with another executive, only to find out that he may have murdered her father. That's the main storyline in the new show, Ava Luna. General Motors also has a big piece of the plot. Ava's agency is hired to create a commercial for the Buick Regal. The ad is then shown during actual breaks in the show. Branding consultant Adam Hanft says this level of product placement is new to Spanish language TV.
What GM is trying to do is make these brands very much a part of the texture, fabric, and culture of the Hispanic community.
Hispanics are expected to spend $40 billion on cars and parts this year. Blair Borther of Hispanic Marketing Resources says advertisers will be watching.
If it works, you are going to see a race to every telenovela trying to get a brand placement going on.
For now, marketers are just revving their engines. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Wall Street ended October on a mixed note. We will have the details when we do the numbers. What we usually do at this point on a Friday is take a look back at the economic news of the week. But really, all the big news, economic and otherwise, is next week. The midterms, of course, also on Wednesday. The Federal Reserve takes its latest stab at trying to turn things around, buying up more government bonds to drive down interest rates, quantitative easing, as it's known. So here for our first ever weekly look ahead of Wall Street and beyond are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also John Carney from CNBC. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here.
Thanks,
Kai,
for having us.
All right, so let's do the Marketplace time warp dance here. Pretend it's Wednesday after the election. The Federal Reserve has not yet announced its quantitative easing plans, Lee, but we do have the election results, and let's say the Republicans got control of the House. What happens on Wall Street?
Well, I think the market goes up, but I think the market goes up anyway simply for the fact that the market loves certainty and will just be so happy to have this election behind us and done and over with.
John, what happens if the Democrats hold the House?
Oh, you will see a massive sell-off. Priced into the market right now is the idea that the Republicans will take the House. If they fail to do that, there will be fears that taxes are going to go up further, that the Obama administration's plans will broaden out because this will look like the public is embracing the Obama administration once again, and the Democratic agenda scares Wall Street. You will see a lot of selling on Wednesday if the Republicans don't do as well as expected.
What happens then 3 hours later, Lee? So Wall Street opens, it does what it does, and then 3 hours later we get the Fed announcement on quantitative easing, and it says, yes, we're going to plow a whole bunch of money into the economy, but not as much as everybody thought. What happens?
You know, I still think we're going to see an uptick from that just because it will be some movement.
You're just all sunshine and light today, aren't you?
I am until you get to this part. the Fed does not have the magic wand that everyone thinks it has. And there's this vast misperception out there that the Fed can just pull this rabbit out of a hat and fix the economy. And that's not entirely the case for a couple of reasons, the biggest being that this recession was not caused by the reasons that most recessions are caused by. That said, it doesn't mean it won't still have a positive psychological impact on the market, and that's huge.
John, talk to me about the Fed. Can they fix where we are and where we want to be, or are they just along for the ride like the rest of us?
Nope, they're just along for the ride like the rest of us. They can't fix it. What Lee was hinting at is that most recessions are actually caused by policy decisions to raise interest rates to fight off inflation. This recession was not caused by a rate hike that the Fed engineered, and so they can't then undo the recession because they weren't the ones who started it. I do want to say that I think Lee is mistaken about the market's likely reaction to a Fed announcement. I think it will be a sell almost no matter what they announce, in part because it is already priced into the market and there will be no more upside from that.
Lee, talk to me about the politics of Wednesday morning. If, as everybody predicts, Republicans have the House, Democrats have the Senate, and Obama's still in the White House, what happens with the economy? Are there going to be moves on tax cuts or foreclosures or anything?
No matter what happens, we're looking at gridlock. We're going to have divided government, especially if this plays out the way we're talking. But I do think, I mean, there's certainly Republicans that can't wait to get their hands into the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill and tweak that and roll that back. But that's going to be really hard. It's going to be a lot of hot air and probably not much action.
John, anything on the banks or this whole foreclosure thing?
Yeah, I do think that we're going to have a lame duck session of Congress, and it's very, very likely there will be an attempt to pass a bill by people in safe seats or people who have already lost their seats so don't care about outraging voters to forgive the banks their foreclosure fraud and flaws, some sort of legislative act that basically bails out the banks from the foreclosure mess that they made.
There's that word again, bailouts, John.
Thing is, this is a cheap bailout because they don't actually have to spend our tax money to do it. They can just sort of say, it's okay.
But if they do that, I mean, the big risk here is then looking like the administration is siding with the fat cat bankers who got us into this mess. I don't think that bill is going to be as easy to pass as John thinks. I also, for the record, don't think we're headed to a double dip recession either.
All right. Well, you guys were a little feisty today. That's good. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Lost in all the television coverage of the midterm elections is this. Besides politicians, November is a pretty important month for television types, too. The November ratings sweeps are among us. That means your favorite show might feature some buzzworthy television stunts, all in the name of grabbing more viewers and higher advertising rates. Television producers and writers do tend to save their best stuff for sweeps, you know, including commentator and co-creator of Lost, Damian Lindelof.
I can't believe that Lost is actually finished. Over 6 seasons, we wrote and produced 121 episodes. And here's a spoiler alert if you still haven't seen the series finale. We managed to kill every single character. Sorry. Anyway, during the course of those 6 years, my life was committed to the telling of a single story. Writing and producing a TV show is a massive commitment, and one must make significant sacrifices to help that show achieve its true potential. In many ways, it's a lot like being a monk, except with less sex. Now, however, I get to do all the wonderful things that I denied myself while my colleagues, who didn't manage to cancel their own shows, must play Sisyphus. And, of course, I quietly judge how well they're rolling their respective boulders from the sanctity of my living room. And here's the thing about boulder rolling. It's a lot more fun to watch than it is to do. And let's be honest. Is it fun to watch? It does, however, make me fondly reminisce about my time in the trenches. And by fondly reminisce, I mean wake up in the middle of the night screaming. Normally around this time of year, an average day would be spent working on 5 episodes of Lost simultaneously. We'd be blue-skying the story for one, writing the script of another, rewriting the script that we'd rushed through previously, shooting the one we'd just rewritten, and editing the one we'd just shot. During this process, I like to spend my downtime curled up in the fetal position, crying. Things would sometimes get so bad, I'd fantasize about ways to destroy the show and alienate the viewers, like having the castaways discover a huge donkey wheel in the middle of the island that had the capability to transport them back in time. Oh, wait. We actually did that. Anyway, life has gotten much better now. November sweeps don't matter, no more fake scripts to keep the mystery secret, no more fans ridiculing me on the internet for wasting 6 years of their lives and betraying their trust. Okay. That last one is still sort of happening a little, but I'm okay with it. I really, really am. The bright side is that in all my free time, I've gotten to do all the things I put off, like hunting the most dangerous game, man himself. And yes, I even curl up in the fetal position and cry, just for old time's sake.
Damon Lindelof is the co-creator of Lost. He's also the writer and producer of the new Star Trek movie, too. If you've got a comment, you know what to do. Drop us a line at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, what could be worse than mortgage-backed securities?
Those mortgage-backed securities are actually now non-mortgage-backed securities.
The return of toxic assets coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, another day of watching paint dry on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials barely budged, ticked up just 4 points, way less than a tenth of 1%, 11,118. NASDAQ didn't even do that. It closed where it was, 2507. The S&P 500 also treaded water, ending where it began, 1183. For the week, also a snore. The Dow dipped 0.1%. The S&P 500 stood in place. The NASDAQ gained 0.1%. For the month, and this ought to get your attention out there, gang, the Dow padded on 0.3%. The NASDAQ climbed just under 6%. The S&P 500 popped up 0.3%. Back to today, though. Everybody's still waiting to see what the Fed's going to do, and voters as well next week. In the meanwhile, Goldman Sachs gave up 1.25% today. Bank of America traded down 0.7%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases personal income and spending figures for September. The world's cheapest car will cost a little more. Tata Motors of India increases the price of its Nano mini car by about 9,000 rupees. That's around 200 bucks. And Ebony Magazine celebrates 65 years of publishing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and it is, I suppose, full disclosure time. I'm not really a Halloween kind of guy. Just don't enjoy being scared, really. So the whole werewolf, vampire, zombie thing that happens this time of year always bothers me a little bit. Forget the monsters for a second, though. It turns out economic ideas can be zombies, too. Theories that refuse to die no matter how wrong they are proved to have been. John Quiggin's an economist at the University of Queensland in Australia. He's got a new book out called, wouldn't you know, Zombie Economics. John, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So you quote several places in this book. You quote John Maynard Keynes and his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Is there a general theory of zombie economics? I mean, can you tie all these things together?
Well, I think I can tie together the package of ideas I'm talking about under the name market liberalism, that we really need to leave as much as possible to markets and get governments out of the road, as opposed to the kind of idea of a mixed economy with a role for both governments and markets that prevailed for most of the post-war period.
All right, so let's pick one and hash it out, shall we?
That's a good idea.
All right. So this idea of the great moderation, that we have beaten the business cycle, that economic volatility is over. Certainly the past 2 years put that one to rest, didn't it?
That's right. And this idea is itself pretty old. We had a new era in the 20s, another in the 60s, and yet another with the so-called great moderation. But nonetheless, people are still defending the idea, and central bankers are looking forward to a resumption of business as usual.
Well, let me ask you this then. If we've got economic models failing right and left all over the place, what are we to believe? Is the problem not perhaps the models, but the economists, you know?
We have to admit that there's an awful lot we don't know about how something as complex as the macroeconomy works, but then try and at least look at the large-scale relationships, which do suggest, for example, that a fiscal stimulus applied at the right time can have a positive effect, that we need to pay attention to aggregate imbalances of the kind that we're building up. Those kinds of things tend to be obscured by an excessive focus on elegant theory.
What are we to do then? How do you, not to carry the metaphor too far, but how do you put a stake through the heart of one of these zombie theories?
After I wrote the book, I saw the movie Zombieland, and rule number two is double tap. You always have to hit them twice. And I talk about the trickle-down theory, that when you help the rich, that helps everybody. I think a theory so convenient to powerful people is never going to be killed permanently.
And the theory about trickle-down economics is in some way coming back to the United States in this debate we're having about the Bush-era tax cuts.
Absolutely. It's suggesting that keeping on giving tax cuts to the top 1 or 5% of the population is going to help everybody else. The evidence is very clear that that's not the case, that the vast majority of the benefits of economic growth have gone to people in the top 10% of the income distribution. Within that 10%, the top 1% has done much better than the remaining 9%. And within that 1%, the top 0.1% has done even better.
Can we have a global economic recovery while these zombie ideas still do walk among us?
Well, we're bound to have some kind of recovery. Obviously, we're past the absolute worst of the crisis, although we're bumping along not going very well. So there will be some kind of recovery. The problem is more that unless we address these ideas and the policies based on these ideas, we're bound to have another crisis. If you look at the efficient markets hypothesis, really the evidence from the dot-com bubble and bust ought to have been enough to tell policymakers that our financial markets aren't rational in that way. Instead, what we got was the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms. Within a couple of years after the crisis, the conventional wisdom was this was an overreaction. Financial markets are great. Let's just keep on growing.
John Quiggin is professor of economics at the University of Queensland down in Australia. His new book is called Zombie Economics: How Dead Ideas Still Walk Among Us. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Even though I personally am not going to go near them, haunted houses are going to be big this weekend. And here at Marketplace, we've got a haunted house story of our own. Haunted housing market story, really. And it goes something like this. Once upon a time, home prices were rising. Home loans were scooped up and bundled into mortgage-backed securities. Investors bought those securities. The housing bubble burst and the toxic asset was born. They terrorized the economy and made mincemeat out of our biggest financial institutions. But enter Uncle Sam, toxic asset slayer, with billions of dollars in taxpayer bailout money. Problem solved, right? Yeah, no. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that like any good horror story, toxic assets have a sequel.
Just when you thought they were dead and buried, toxic assets are back.
This is banking at its worst, part two.
Marilyn Cohen heads Envision Capital Management. She says the carelessness we saw during the home buying mania spawned this latest crisis over foreclosures.
Everybody wanted to buy homes, and so we had a mountain of paperwork that had to be processed by the mortgage originators and by the title insurance companies and by the banks, and they couldn't keep up. And they cut corners beyond anybody's worst nightmares, and it not only turned into a nightmare on Elm Street, but Maple Street and Main Street.
Now that the banks are trying to foreclose on people, all that corner cutting has come back to haunt them. So the first time around, mortgage-backed securities were toxic because the loans inside of them were bad. Now, the same mortgage-backed securities are toxic again. But this time, it's paperwork?
Well, paperwork matters.
Georgetown law professor Adam Levitin says if loan documents weren't properly created or processed, banks can't prove they own a mortgage and can't force a delinquent borrower out of a home. Banks have defended their moves to foreclose as legitimate. They say there are some paperwork problems, but that they can be fixed. But Levitin says it's not so simple.
You're going to have to go and track down all the paperwork. And that's not a simple task, especially as a number of the major institutions that were involved are out of business. There's a question about, even if you can find the paperwork, whether it's possible to fix it as a matter of law.
Levitin says the complex machine financial institutions put in place to sell mortgage securities is backfiring because mortgage documents had to get passed through a complex web of lenders, packagers, and investors. One clerical error along the way could raise questions about the rightful owner of a mortgage and could legally gut an entire mortgage-backed security.
In some sense, they're toxic because they might not be there. If the chain of title isn't correct, it means that the mortgages never got transferred. So those mortgage-backed securities are actually now non-mortgage-backed securities.
That's right. Zombie bonds.
No. No.
Levitin says the only way those investors could get their money out is by forcing the bank that sold them the bonds to buy them back. which probably means lawsuits.
It's a pleasure to welcome you to our conference this morning. To
Earlier this week in Midtown Manhattan, law firm Grace and Ellsworth held a meeting for investors in mortgage-backed securities. It was a full house. Attorney Talcott Franklin was talking about his class action suit. He says investors have been flocking to him.
We're basically to the point where we're signing up a couple of clients a day. This is just like a snowball effect.
Which could turn into an avalanche. Some heavyweights, including the New York Federal Reserve and bond giant PIMCO, are demanding Bank of America buy back more than $16 billion worth of mortgage loans that they say were mishandled. Scott Simon heads up PIMCO's asset-backed securities team. He wouldn't comment on the case, but says if the paperwork isn't right, that's on the banks.
If the loans aren't up to standards, the typical thing would be that they would buy them back. This is why contracts exist, right? So, you know, if I tell you I'm going to sell you a car for $25,000 and you bring me a Tonka toy car, I'm hoping that, you know, that would be covered in my contract.
There's no telling how many lawsuits there will be over these zombie bonds.
No, no, no!
Or how serious the paperwork problem is. Some estimates say the banks could be on the hook for more than $100 billion, far more than they've set aside, but far less than the first toxic asset crisis. In the meantime, banks, the federal government, and would-be homebuyers are hoping that, like most sequels, Toxic Assets Part 2 won't be as scary as the original. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation of what did not happen on Wall Street on the non-economic news of the day. Reports confirmed this afternoon by the White House that there actually were explosives found in air cargo packages bound for the United States. Airline stocks were calm. UPS, whose planes were searched in Dubai and in the UK, barely budged. FedEx was down, but just a little bit. The president did say this afternoon he's going to step up security, but that if you've got a big Halloween weekend travel plan thing going on, you ought to just go ahead and go. And that is what we're going to do on a Friday afternoon. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ticked up just 4 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ closed where it opened. The S&P 500 also ended right where it started. Our theme music is composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Did you ever dream of being in a band?
When I was younger, we thought we hit it big, and it was great. We were making good money for your person in your 20s. But you know what? I have to work, just like every other schmuck.
Rock stars gotta eat. You know, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here Monday afternoon.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.